Today's podcast is brought to you by Gamefly.com. Sign up for a premium free 30-day one-game-out trial specifically for Picture Lock listeners at GameflyOffer.com/PictureLock. You're listening to WERA LP Arlington 96.7 FM. Welcome to another episode of the world-famous, award-winning Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, filmmaker, film festival director, Washington, D.C. area, and North Carolina film critic, and lover of film and TV. You can find all the back episodes and so much more at PictureLockShow.com. It's hard to believe I've hit 40 episodes of Picture Lock on the radio, but this is it, folks. 40 hours of good old-fashioned film talk. That's pretty cool. So, what am I going to do for episode 40? Well, I had a good talk with Paul LaValle about realism in cinema, so today he's back to talk about formalism in cinema. It's a great conversation, and you can actually follow along. That's right, if you want to watch the scenes we're talking about, I'm going to list them off right now. So run to your computer, Google an Andalusian dog, Andalusian, A-N-D-A-L-U-S-I-O-N, dog, Battleship Potemkin's Odessa Steppe scene, The Untouchables with Kevin Costner, Stairway Shootout, and finally, Collateral's jazz scene. Now, I promise if you Google those, you should be able to find the scenes. If not, just check out the podcast and you can actually follow along that way as well. There's tons of scenes, but I promise it'll be a good time. That's all ahead on Picture Lock.
Hello, this is Brian Frankel, entertainment lawyer and producer, and you are listening to Picture Lock.
Hey, this is Olivia Batista, writer, producer, and star of Here We Wait, which you can check out at herewewait.com, and you're listening to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and I'm really excited to have my next guest on today, friend of the show. Back in episode 22, I talked with Paul LaValle about realism in cinema, and he's back to educate me and you again. He's the executive director of Arlington Independent Media. Paul LaValle, welcome back to Picture Lock.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here. Okay, now for the quiz from last time. See how much you remember. No, I'm kidding.
There's no quiz.
No, there's no quiz. In fact, we were just saying before we started recording that in film criticism, there is no right answer. That's the beauty part. If you want a right answer, you should study mathematics. Because in film criticism, it's just whoever makes the best argument, right?
That's what I want to say, but you might have to talk to some of my professors in grad school because they weren't always kind to me.
Well, that's because you weren't making a good argument.
Oh, all right. Well, we're going to have to, I'm going to have to make a good argument today as we talk about what is formalism in film.
Okay, so I think we need to kind of start where we left off last time, talking about realism. And Andre Bazin, remember, was the person that we were kind of referencing. And his ideas about how the power of cinema comes from the fact that it's this mechanical recording of reality, that there is no human intervention, and it gives the cinema a kind of objectivity that no other art form can match, in that it preserves the time-space continuum right on film. It's just a mechanical recording, photochemical process of what's out there. Light rays are reflected into the camera lens. They're captured. They form the image. A motion picture camera makes that image move. And the reason that's important to Bazin was because that meant we could believe in movies. It's seeing is believing is kind of, you know, the thought behind that. If you see it on film, then that's what it looked like. We can trust it in a way that we can't trust a painting or a sculpture, because those require the artists to intervene, you know, to be the medium through which reality is interpreted. But in the cinema, the artist is one step removed in that the camera is doing this mechanical recording. So that's the idea behind realism. The idea behind formalism is kind of the opposite. And so the person that I want to reference in terms of formalism was a writer by the name of Rudolf Arnheim. And so he came out of the Gestalt Psychology School, and he was interested in not how film is a mechanical recording of reality, but actually how it isn't. And that argument was faulty from the start, because there were many ways in which film did not capture reality, that it could not capture reality. Mm-hmm. And for example, he would point out that film is a two-dimensional medium, whereas obviously reality exists in at least three dimensions. And
right.
Film can't capture that three-dimensional aspect, even though nowadays we're trying, but not very successfully. Mm-hmm. Also, when Arnheim was writing, which was quite some time ago, film was basically a black and white medium. And so he would point out that, you know, reality exists in full color. Film, at best, even when you use Technicolor or other processes, is only approximating that, you know, those colors in reality. And most of the time it's in black and white. Mm-hmm. Also, film, you know, what he would say, it delimits the scene in that there are four frames, right? The four walls of the frame.
Right.
And so that's not how we see reality. And so the fact that the film can't show you everything that your visual field would normally show you is a limit, you know, is a way film cannot reproduce reality. So anyway, you add up all these ways that film doesn't mechanically record reality. And then Arnheim argued that is the raw material. It's kind of the palette that the artist has to work with. In other words, by manipulating those very ways that film cannot capture reality, mm-hmm. is how art is made. Because when Arnheim was writing, there was argument going on in film criticism and in film scholars and among film scholars and even just kind of the casual observer about whether or not film could be art. So this, you have to remember, is back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And there were many people who argued that film can't be art because it's just this mechanical recording of reality. Mm-hmm. And so how is that art? You know, that's just turn the camera on, it records the scene, you know, the end. But Arnheim argued that there are all these ways that film couldn't capture reality, and that those were the ways that film could be used to make art. So the artist, the director, has on his or her palette the frame to manipulate.
Right.
The shadows, the fact that it's two-dimensional, the fact that you can't tell the relative size of any object in the screen, the fact that there is this constant interruption of the time-space continuum every time you edit. Mm-hmm. So editing, framing, lighting, color, those become the palette that the artist has to work with. And so that kind of forms the backbone or the idea behind formalism, that you can manipulate all of these various elements within the film in order to create your artistic vision. So this is completely different than what Bazin felt film should be, which is like the director should kind of stay out of it. Mm-hmm. Let the film or let the scene transpire in front of the camera. Let the camera keep up with it as best as it can. But what's important is that the filmmaker not interfere, not manipulate. Arnheim's arguing the opposite, that's when film becomes interesting, when the artist does manipulate to create their own version of reality.
You're listening to Picture Hawk. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the executive director of Arlington Independent Media, Paul LaValle. And I guess so. You should also say, Paul, you are a professor at George Mason University as well. And as you can tell from that education that we just got on formalism and film, he has no notes, folks. This is straight off of his brain. So it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm amazing. Thank you. No, everyone at home is on Wikipedia right now going, no, I don't think that's what it's about. Right.
All right. So I do think that you set it up well, though, because like you said, instead of let's just, you know, sit back and just see what happens in front of the film as we analyze with realism, it's more of how do we take everything, whether it's the camera, the lighting,
even sound, just to, you know, manipulate our audience, and that becomes like the art form.
Correct? Exactly.
All right. So, you know, folks, this is going to be an interactive episode. We're going to try to check out a few different scenes and different films to give some examples of this. And hopefully for any of the filmmakers that might be listening, you might try to take a few things and put it into your films. I don't know. We'll see. All right. So, Paul, let's see. Where do we want to start? Are we going to...
We were thinking about taking a look at a film from the early 20th century. It's a 1929 film created by Louis Buñuel and Salvador Dali. And the reason I wanted to pick this film is because it was an early attempt at making art. I mean, making a film that was to be appreciated as art. So it's not necessarily about the story. It's not necessarily about the characters. It's supposed to be appreciated much like you would appreciate a painting.
You know, I kind of want to... This is interesting because I personally had not seen this film. We just looked kind of at the opening segment, and we'll look at this in a second. But for me personally, sometimes I see something like this and I'm like, where's the story? Where's the... And so in some ways it's like, where's the art in this? Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to see how we can find that, because of course with paintings, we can go into a museum and something might stand out to me and it might, you know, not to you. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what you think about this.
Okay.
All right. All right, so folks at home, if you are able to find An Andalusian Dog, A-N-D-A-L-U-S-I-A-N, Dog, as in D-O-G, just play the beginning of it, and you'll be able to keep up. So if you could, Paul, give us a little commentary. We first see this guy. He's looks like he's sharpening a razor.
That's correct. And then he steps out onto the balcony, smoking a cigarette, staring at the moon. Then there's a woman seated next to him. He takes the razor. There's a cut to a famous match cut as the clouds float by the moon, kind of slicing the moon in two. He slices the woman's eyeball in two. Obviously, it's not a woman's eyeball that he cuts, but it appears to be in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the mistakes that people make as they watch Andalusian Dog, and now we're watching a nun, actually a man in drag,
right,
riding a bicycle down the street. One of the mistakes that people make as they watch Andalusian Dog is they try to figure out the story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've seen this film because I used to teach it every semester, so I've seen it dozens of times.
Mm-hmm.
There's no story. So just, you know, chill, because if you're trying to figure out what this is about, you're going to, you know, you're kind of missing the idea behind it. If you stood in front of a Salvador Dali painting,
mm-hmm,
and tried to figure out what it was about, that'd be a difficult task because it's surreal, you know, that's
right,
the whole point. It's supposed to be about the interior monologue of the artist, and the artist is just putting their kind of their mind on canvas. Well, that's what they're doing here. So they're using character and they're using plot and story to a degree,
mm-hmm,
but really only as a vehicle for their artistic vision.
And so I'm going to go back to the beginning with that match cut between the clouds and the woman's eye. One, when he steps out, there's no woman. I didn't see her.
No.
And suddenly, she suddenly appears.
That happens all the time in this film. There's a famous scene coming up. We're not quite there yet, but where, you know, he steps out of the door of the apartment there. It looks like they're in Paris. I'm not sure where they are. But he steps outside of the door, and he's on the beach. So there is this constant violation of the time-space continuum. It's part, mm-hmm, of the whole point of the film. There's a constant violation of the, you know, the whole idea of reality. It's just, it's a series of scenes. Oh, here we have a man staring at the ants crawling out of the hole in his hand, and that's another typical kind of visual image in this film, something like what you might see in a surreal painting.
Right. which is interesting because Salvador Dali, obviously, like, that's what, like, you would expect to see. But, you know, it kind of also makes me think about how we dream, right? Like, most of the times, dreams, there's no beginning, middle, and end. It just, you're 1 second you and I are talking, the next second you're on a beach or,
exactly,
you know, and when did that stop? When did that start? You don't really know.
That's right. That's right. And here we have a man poking at a, you know, a severed hand that's lying on the street. And he's, of course, surrounded by a crowd of onlookers. You know, pretty soon that will that scene will change in a surprising and unexpected way and in an impossible way.
Mm-hmm.
You never know in the film where anybody is in relation to anyone else. There's a constant violation that of the whole, you know, construction of glance object, where if a character turns to look at something and then you cut to that thing, we're presuming that you're seeing it from point of view.
Right.
But that is violated over and over again in this film in ways that, you know, it can't obviously be the person's point of view that we were just seeing glancing at the object.
But again, going back to formalism, I think this is when the director is telling you what he or she wants you to actually see, versus, you know, kind of putting it out there. Like we said with realism, where it's just, okay, we'll just see this person, like, how did this hand get there? And we're just going to watch as everyone
exactly
analyzes.
That's exactly it. And so eventually, I think you're, as you watch the film, you're forced to kind of admit to yourself, this doesn't make any sense. And so what is it for? It's not for telling the story, so it must be to be appreciated as the sort of interior monologue of the artist. And then we start to realize, well, film doesn't have to just be about telling stories. It can be about being appreciated as a work of art.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the project of formalism, is to get us to think of film as being not just a narrative vehicle, but a vehicle for artistic expression. And the artist manipulates all those aspects of film in order to create their own vision and get you to see things the way they see them.
You know, it's funny because this, as we're watching this, it reminds me of Man with a Movie Camera.
Yeah.
Ziga Vertov. And it's kind of the same, similar thing, but the juxtaposition in which he was able to use film to kind of speak on the times and politically what was going on. So he was, you know, showing someone that was actually getting shaved, right? Mm-hmm. So we see one guy getting kind of pampered, and then we see another guy that's grinding an axe. Now, when you look in the frame, you'll notice that he's missing some fingers. Mm-hmm. So he kind of puts the have versus the have-nots, then inserts himself within the film. You see him cranking the camera and things like that. So, yeah, it's this is really some interesting stuff, Paul.
Well, I agree. Thank you. That's an interesting point about Man with a Movie Camera and the whole idea of being political, because this film, Andalusian Dog, is very apolitical. I mean, there's really no, at least not that I've ever been able to discern, no political message here whatsoever, just like there's no real political message in your basic Dali painting.
Mm-hmm.
But formalism has been used to great effect politically. And I refer to the next film that I think we're going to look at, which is Battleship Potemkin by Sergei Eisenstein.
Mm-hmm.
So a very similar project in that the filmmaker, Eisenstein, is manipulating the elements of film that are not just the mere recording of reality in order to create art. But of course, Eisenstein was a Soviet, you know, he was a Bolshevik basically. And so there was no art for art's sake allowed.
Yeah.
And so art had to be in the service of the state and had to be in the service of the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so Eisenstein creates this movie about the Battleship Potemkin, which was a famous incident in the revolution where the sailors on this battleship mutiny and then sail it into the Odessa port. And they're welcomed as heroes by the people in Odessa. because the, you know, they've thrown off the boot of the czar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, Eisenstein made this film to commemorate that very important moment in the revolution. But the, my point right now is that he used many of the same techniques, especially in terms of editing, that were explored by other formalists or artists in the early 20th century, but not just to create art, but to create a political statement.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I just got to put this plug in just because I'm getting so engrossed in this conversation. I might forget to tell you, I have Paul LaValle, Executive Director of Arlington Independent Media, with me. We're analyzing some films from the past, and we'll come up to somewhat recent present to talk about formalism in film. So, Paul, let's go ahead and jump into the Odessa steppe scene in Battleship Potemkin. Again, this is the 1925 film. It's interesting that all of these films are kind of in the 20s. From what we looked at, Man with a Movie Camera, Battleship Potemkin. So it seems like the formalism is really kind of coming around during that time.
Yeah, I think so. I think people were starting to really realize the potential of this medium for something not, I shouldn't say not just storytelling, because of course narrative is what film is really good at, but things in addition to narrative, ways of communicating that don't just have to do with plot and story.
Mm-hmm.
So this scene that we're looking at right now is probably one of the most famous scenes in all of movie history.
Yeah, every film school, you gotta watch this.
you must, yeah. Whether you want to or not. But it's pretty good. I mean, it's pretty interesting. So what's happening, for those of you at home, is this: the battleship has sailed in. The town has come out to welcome the sailors. Unfortunately, the Tsar sends his troops to break up the crowd, to break up the party. And so the troops approach the crowd who's gathered on the steps that lead down to the wharf. So the soldiers start marching down the steps and pushing the crowd ahead of them, and then they start firing into the crowd, which causes a panic. And the whole scene takes, I don't know, several minutes, but it focuses on a few of the individuals in the crowd, including a small child who's killed and his mother who fights through the crowd to get the child. And all the while, the panic continues and the people are rushing down the steps and the soldiers are ruthlessly marching after them and shooting as they go. It's quite a scene.
I think one of the things that always stands out to me is it's a great use of A plus B equals C, right? So we see the soldiers shoot, and then we'll see in the next frame, you know, somebody might grab their stomach or, they fall down. And so A plus B equals C, we assume that they were shot. But we never really see that within the frame, maybe like you would within realism, where you definitely know that's what happened, even though on film, of course, we would assume it's a squib or something that went off. But I think it's an excellent use of that medium where we don't actually see that, but we automatically assume like that's what happened.
That's a really interesting point. Eisenstein was like Hitchcock in a way. He was extremely detailed in his planning, and he considered the elements of the film, like the graphic composition of the frame. If you look at this sequence, the steps run kind of diagonally through the frame in most of the shots.
Right.
Then there's the so that's a really key thing for him, the graphic design of the shot and that really strong diagonal. Then there's the motion of the people within the frame. Most everybody moving left to right as they go down the steps, kind of upper left to lower right. But when the woman picks up her son and she carries him back up the steps to confront the soldiers as they're marching, that's a key moment in the whole sequence. She's walking back up against the motion, And so for Eisenstein, this kind of thing was really important because he based his thinking about film and film production on the whole idea of dialectics. So in the, and I don't want to get into too much about, you know, the
let's whole do it, concept Paul, let's of, do it.
dialectical materialism, which was the, you know, the idea behind the revolution. But real quickly, the idea is that change or a new way of being comes about when opposing forces are brought into proximity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a historical, you know, way of looking at the world that the revolution was this new, brand new way of being, like it's the new human. And it was brought about by the conflict between Tsarist Russia, which was feudal in nature, and the revolution. So when those two things collided, it created this new, you know, what they thought was going to be the savior of the world, this new human that lived in a worker's paradise, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Eisenstein took that kind of thinking, that dialectical thinking, and applied it to his movie making. So he brings his shots into conflict. He brings the motion of one person against the, you know, the ruthless motion of the troops, brings those two things directly into contact, moving at each other.
Mm-hmm.
When he discussed his films, he used really strong language, like his shots would, you know, blast away, you know, preconceived notions, that it would, you know, use like really almost violent imagery and language when he talked about his films, because mm-hmm. what he was trying to do was manipulate all these elements to bring them into conflict and hopefully then create this third understanding. So your point about A plus B equals C, I think he'd love to hear that, because because those two shots brought into conflict then create this understanding that wasn't really there before.
Right. No, and I think that's amazing. I guess I hadn't really noticed that the first 50 million times I saw this, maybe not 50 million, maybe the first two. But you're right, just in terms of how, as a filmmaker, he's able to suddenly give you something that's different from the norm. So it made that emotional scene so much more impactful, because like you said, she was going against the grain of what everyone else was doing. I think at the same time, kind of going into this, is that whole Soviet montage in terms of how they were also experimenting with, you know, again, juxtaposition of frames. How can I take this this frame and then make it clash, as you're saying, right, with the next one? And even at the end, once, you know, the boy or baby goes down the steps, you kind of see we get a close up of this guy that's like hitting, I think, the woman mm-hmm. right after. And you see her glasses are smashed. It's just it's meant to jar you. In such a way that I think as viewers, you know, you either kind of want to turn away or you really want to think about what is he trying to say.
That's exactly right. So the whole concept that behind this was he referred to as the montage of attractions. So he felt like in all movies, there were going to be those moments where the audience, or the goal was to create moments where the audience would go, wow. Just like, and he used the analogy of the circus attraction.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to the Big Top, right? And, you know, the people up on the trapeze are doing these amazing things, that like death-defying moments where the audience just goes, wow.
Right.
So at that moment, the audience is what he called pre-intellectual. They're not thinking about it. They're just experiencing it. They're just reacting in a kind of a primitive and gut level way.
Mm-hmm.
Those moments were super important to Eisenstein. And if you could bring those moments into conflict through montage, you could create this sort of higher level of understanding.
Yeah.
So.
And this is some deep stuff. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking to the man with all the deepness, Paul LaValle. We're talking about formalism in film. All right, so right before we take a quick break, you know what? I think I'm looking at the time. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll follow up that Odessa steps scene with 1987's The Untouchables. Don't go anywhere.
Let's take a quick break for promos. Stay tuned.
For you, the listeners of Picture Locks Podcast, Gamefly is offering a premium free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I used to play PlayStation a ton pre-kids. I had money to buy the latest game out, but I really don't have the time or money like I used to give towards my hobby. That's why Gamefly makes so much sense. For a low monthly fee, I can get the latest console and handheld game delivered to my door. I keep it as long as I want and can send it right back to get a new one. The cool thing is, if you like a game so much that you don't want to send it back, you can keep it for a low used price. There are never any due dates or late fees. To get your free trial today, go to gameflyoffer.com/picturelock. Again, that's gameflyoffer.com/picturelock for your free 30-day trial.
Hey everybody, this is Leslie Green, founder and CEO of Golden Life Ventures. You're listening to Picture Lock.
Hey, this is Dan Franco from The Night Watchman, and you're listening to Picture Lock.
Welcome back. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and I just missed the opportunity to have Paula Valley, Executive Director of Arlington Independent Media, shower me with glowing praises because I didn't hit record in Pro Tools.
I take it all back.
Right. I can't prove it now. Oh, man. We're talking about formalism in film, but it's been a great time. I've really enjoyed it, and I've definitely enjoyed my time here at Arlington Independent Media.
Well, as I was saying, we're going to miss you, and we appreciate everything you've done for us, and it's nice to hear that you felt like you had a good time, too.
Yeah, most definitely. Again, you know, I started Picture Lock as a blog, and then when I came here, just being able to take it to TV and now radio. It's just been, it's been a privilege. It's been exciting, and I definitely know that without Arlington Independent Media, I don't think it would be, you know, as big as it is. So I'm definitely grateful for my time.
Well, good. We're gonna miss you.
I will miss you guys too. All right, so we were looking at the Odessa Steps just a while ago. And now we're going to actually take a look at 1987, Brian De Palma's The Untouchables. And so in this scene, we actually have where Elliot Ness, played by Kevin Costner, is arriving at the train station, Union Station. And I think that this is also, not only does it pay homage to the Odessa Step sequence, right? But I think it's also a great example of formalism. One of the things about this scene is the pacing of it. It's so slow. And I think as we were kind of talking about earlier in terms of how we use just kind of pace as well as different frames to make a clash, an impact, so you know what's going on. So as the scene kind of starts out, we see Costner, he's looking around, he's analyzing what's going on. And so, you know, in many ways, I feel like, you know, with the formalist theory, that what we're able to do that we can't do in real life is we're able to kind of get inside his head. Now, even though it's not like a narrative saying, you know, I saw a woman and I saw bad guys coming in the door, you can tell by the way that the frame, you know, we take the time to look at Costner's face in close up. We see he's looking around and trying to see what time it is. See, you know, this woman that is obviously struggling getting her baby up the steps, which looks a little hokey, actually, to me. But then he makes this decision that he's going to actually help the woman to get, you know, up the stairs with her baby. Now, the thing that De Palma does with his camera is we finally get like a wide. And so I think what he does really well in this sequence is that he establishes where we actually are within Union Station, and we know kind of where the clock is, where the baby was, and where people are kind of actually coming in and out of. And so I think Ness sees, is that a villain?
Yeah. So one of the really interesting things about this sequence is how much of it is shot in point of view. So again, as you were pointing out, we're supposed to be kind of understanding the scene or from inside his head. And thankfully, De Palma didn't use a voiceover.
Yeah.
Because this is like the laziest technique ever.
Right.
If you can't indicate what a character is thinking and feeling with, you know, all the other elements at your disposal, and you have to rely on the voiceover to tell us, then I think you kind of missed the boat a little bit. But
right.
Here we do really get what's going on inside his head because of the liberal use of point of view. So there's all this glance object construction where he turns, he looks, then we see what he's looking at, then it zooms in a bit. So we understand it's important. Then he shoots the guy. So, you know, now we get it.
Right.
Now we know what's going on.
I think the other thing to be said is we're actually watching this on mute so that we can actually record. But if it was off of mute, you know, the entire time while Elliot Ness, Kevin Costner, he's pulling the baby up the steps, the mom is just talking. And it's one of those moments in life where, you know, you're focused, you're hearing what's going on, but your focus is split.
Right.
And so you hear her talking, but that's just like background noise. What's really important within the scene is the guys that are actually coming in.
Right.
And so, you know, as once, you know, kind of chaos, you know, or havoc is wreaked, suddenly it makes everything that much more intense. You know, and as you said, the manipulation of space and time, we have the slow motion of the baby.
That's a classic element that's manipulated by filmmakers all the time.
Right.
But here it really works well. I think, you know, it conveys that whole idea of when things get this wild, it's almost like time slows down. I mean, you kind of get transported into a whole different frame of reference, and it does a great job at indicating that.
Right. And so it's one of those things that it's totally preposterous. I don't see how, you know, you can shoot all these different guys. Andy Garcia runs in, throws a gun, you know, slides into home and saves the baby carriage.
Yeah, that was quite a major league move right there.
Right. But I think going into what we've been talking about and what you're saying is this is really a manipulation of the medium and turning it into an artistic thing.
Agreed.
Like, we're able to just really kind of get hooked in to what's going on in terms of, you know, is he going to save the baby? The fact that in some ways innocence coming down the stairs in the midst of chaos, bloody violence, is really key. I think as audience members that we're just like, oh my gosh, you know, don't let the baby die. But
agreed.
Yet, at the same time, like, I guess we don't care too much for the sailor that got shot in the neck.
Right. Well, it's a perfect example of the concept of the attraction. You know, this baby, in the midst of, like you say, this violent chaos, it's a real moment of wow. And then to, you know, use that as an element in this scene, I think is something Eisenstein would like. I think he'd appreciate this homage.
Nice. All right, so we're going to move over to 2004's Collateral. This is directed by Michael Mann, and it stars Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx. Basically, in the synopsis, a cab driver finds himself the hostage of an engaging contract killer as he makes his rounds from hit to hit during one night in Los Angeles. Now, the reason that I felt like this was a more modern formalism film is because Michael Mann is one of those directors who, I guess, as you might say, like a Michael Bay, like they have this distinct style. You know it when you see it. And with Michael Mann, with him, it's more about the cinematography that he has in his films. And then it's the style in terms of his kind of crime genre films as well. So I wanted to take a look at this one scene in Collateral, in which Tom Cruise is going into the jazz club to what we don't realize, I guess, as the audience. So spoiler alert, if you haven't seen 2004's Collateral, Cruise, his character's name is Vincent. Vincent is on the job. And so he goes into this jazz club, and we think he's just chilling for a bit, and he speaks to Daniel, who is played by Barry Shabaka Henley, a really great character actor. And so, Daniel is telling this great story about the time that he plays with Miles Davis.
No, no, see, I was about 19, bussing tables right here. The money went. But that wasn't the point. It was about being around the music, and I was. Let me take this one night. July 22nd, 1964. Who do you think walks to that door?
Bye, baby.
Miles Davis.
That's right. In the flesh.
That's right. I'm talking about through those doors, the coolest man on the planet.
Jeez.
Anyway, he had been a recording session up at Columbia, up on Vine. So Miles comes to that door. Before you know it, he's up on the bandstand, jamming with the band.
It had to be.
Oh, it was scary. I mean, the dude was so focused, man. Plus, he was kind of a scary cat anyway. Huh? I mean, everybody and mama knew that you don't just come up and talk to Miles Davis. I mean, he may have looked like he was chilling, but he was absorbed. I mean, this one young hip couple went up and tried to shake his hand one day. And the guy says, hi, my name is, I said, get the fuck out of my face, you giant mother. Take your silly bitch with you. You know, that's that was Miles, man. That's the way he was when he was in his musical headspace. Fierce.
But did you get to talk to him?
I'm better than that.
No.
I played for about 20 minutes.
Unbelievable.
How'd you do?
How'd I do? Well, you really ain't when you're playing next to Miles Davis. But he carried my ass.
What did he say?
He said one word. Cool.
Cool. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. That meant good, but not ready. It meant, look me up when you are.
Did you?
No. I got drafted and ran into some other things, and by the time I got back to music, season had passed. But you know, I was born in 1945, but that night was the moment of my conception, right here in this room.
Crowd's not here now.
Well, jazz ain't the draw that it used to be.
This is an excellent scene, by the way. I'm so glad you picked it, because it's a formalism of a whole different kind. The way he uses color, in particular, in this scene is really great, and also his use of shallow focus, you know, works really well. So those are two elements in film that can be the artist's palette. You know, the artist can use as elements to manipulate.
Right. And so this is one of those scenes I think that if you see it more than once, then you kind of get it. Because with Vincent, he's listening. Again, it's kind of that split in terms of concentration, where he's listening and he's looking around. So he's watching the staff. He sees everyone is kind of cleared out. And then he asks this one question. And suddenly, man takes his camera and he pushes in into an uncomfortable over the shoulder that is like really claustrophobic versus what we just had, which was an over the shoulder that kind of had a little bit of space in it. But it totally, he changes not only where the camera is, so we get a little dolly action to the side, but then also the frame size. And I think that it works so well, because Vincent says, like, no, I'm here to work. And so he just mentions, the people and blah, blah, blah. And then Daniel's face is just, it changes. And he knows, okay, I'm in trouble. And now there's this immense tension. Of course, we break it up a little bit with Jamie Foxx and, you know, him cracking a joke here or there. But for the most part, we're staying in tight on the characters. I just think it's an excellent use of the medium.
I agree. And the thing about this scene is, we're watching it without the sound. You don't need the sound.
Right.
You can watch this scene and know exactly what's happening without any audio.
That's true.
And I think that's the mark of a filmmaker who really knows what he's doing. You know, as you pointed out, the use of extreme close-up to just makes the audience very uncomfortable. And that all changed at that one moment. In the whole scene, you know, our understanding of it pivots right on that moment.
Right.
Like we, at first we think it's just, like you say, a chill moment in an otherwise extremely violent movie. And it's kind of like we're going, phew, you know,
yeah.
Take a break. Great. You know, let's tell a funny story about Miles Davis. And then all of a sudden, it's not that. And just really well done.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think also you got to give a hats off to the actor because, man, the way that he just tells the story about when he met Miles Davis, it just draws you in.
It so, really does.
So you're really, there's no wasted space in terms of the story and the way that it's delivered. But then once you've gotten lulled in and that switch happens, yeah. it's great filmmaking.
What a great story. Mm. I gotta tell the people in Culiacan and Cartagena that story.
You know the folks in Culiacan and Cartagena?
Rich, huh?
That is when I thought you were a cool guy.
I'm a cool guy. The job I contracted to do.
Come on, Vincent. Give the dude a pass.
I'm working here.
No, listen. You don't want to sit up here talking about improvisation and everything like that. You like the guy. You like how he plays. Let's just play a little jazz. Come on.
Improvise? That's funny coming from you. How's this? I'll ask a question.
What question?
Jazz question. You get it right. We roll. You disappear tonight.
If I walk out of here tonight, I will go so far away, it'll be just like I was dead. And one more thing. These people and their rep here, Felix, well, you tell them I'm sorry. You tell them I had to. They laid a grant of immunity on me. I was compelled. It was either play ball or go back inside, and I'm not going back inside. Late on me.
Where did Miles learn music?
I know everything there is to know about Miles.
Then let's have it. Music school. You got it at music school, right?
His father was a dentist. East St. Louis. Invested in agriculture, made plenty of money. He sent Miles to Juilliard School of Music, New York, 1945.
Agreed. Yeah, good choice.
I appreciate it. All right, Paul, so that'll bring us to, I guess, the end of our discussion of formalism in cinema. Are there any good, like, books? Because you usually, Paul, he'll give me Bazan and all kinds of different books to read and things to see. What are some good things that people could check out if they wanted to delve into formalism a little more?
Well, I guess I would recommend two things, both of which are pretty old and dusty, but I think, you know, really germane to the point. The first is Rudolf Arnheim's book. It's called Film as Art. And he delves deep into this idea of using the ways that film is not merely a recording of reality as the artist's palette and the things that to manipulate to create art. So there's that. And then Sergei Eisenstein, you know, not only a filmmaker, but also a brilliant theorist and a great writer. And he wrote two books, but the one I would, well, he wrote more than that, but there are two main books, Film Form and Film Sense. And I think of the two, Film Form is probably the one I would recommend. I mean, they're both very interesting, but I think Film Form is really where he kind of lays down his basic ideas about how the medium should be used. I will say about Eisenstein, it's not easy going. first of all, the translation I'm pretty sure isn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, he was a filmmaker's theoretician. I mean, he really gets into it. So if that's your thing, you'll love it. If you're looking for, you know, more casual kind of experience, then I think Arnheim is probably the better.
Okay. All right. Well, Paul, I really did enjoy the realism episode and this episode. These are like classics. This is what
we
got to
start talking. We got to do one about ideology. I mean, we got to talk about, you know, how film is a medium for constructing social reality. I mean, I think that'd be fun.
Yeah. All right. So you heard it here, folks. Paul said he's coming back. We're going to talk about ideology in film.
Yeah.
All right, Paul. So if you could, how can people reach you or at least check out Arlington Independent Media?
Well, I think if I were them, I would do two things. First of all, I'd go to the web at arlingtonmedia.org or wera.fm. And you can find out a lot about what's going on here at either one of those websites. And then if you're in the area and you'd like to come by, every Monday at 6 p.m. we offer a free tour. We'll show you around. We'll talk about what we do and why we do it. And we'll hear about what you've got in mind. And we'll see if we can't help you out.
Awesome. All right, Paul. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this again. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Paul LaValle, for geeking out with me once again on film. You can find Picture Lock on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and Periscope. All social media is at Picture Lock Show. Watch back episodes of the TV show at youtube.com/Picture Lock Show. Just did the red carpet at DC Web Fest. So you can definitely find some of those great interviews that I did there on the YouTube channel. You can download the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play Music, and other places podcasts are downloaded. Feel free to give the show a hearty review if you're enjoying it. Filmmakers, make sure you get your work into the DC Black Film Festival, showcasing quality film, web series, and television content by and about people of African descent. Call for submissions is now open. Visit dcbff.org for details on how to submit. The showcase will take place August 17th through 19th in Southeast Washington, D.C. at the Beautiful Miracle Theater. So make sure you get your submission in. Don't forget to check out the website picturelockshow.com for movie reviews, news, and to subscribe to our newsletter to get a chance to win tickets for movie screenings in the DMV. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, you can fill out the form on the website. Drop me a line if you're enjoying the show as well at picturelockshow@gmail.com. All music is done by Mike S. The Prophet 13. Thanks, bro. I'm Kevin Sampson, and until next time, I hope you stay locked on film.
Ride sharing is all the rave these days. Wherever you're headed, count on Lyft for rides and minutes. Whether you're riding solo or with friends, with Lyft, you've got options. Get picked up by one of their drivers who will get you where you need to go. When the ride ends, just pay and rate your driver through your phone. It's quick, it's easy, and just a couple taps away. Visit Lyft.com for more details. And if you haven't tried Lyft yet, but want to give it a whirl with a $50 ride credit, sign up at Lyft.com/invited/picturelockshow. That's right. If you're a new member to Lyft and in an eligible market, you can get a $50 ride credit with Picture Lock. Again, that's Lyft.com/invited/picturelockshow for a free $50 ride credit.